side tangent, or like 65th side tangent for the book of James. We're going to get back into the actual text here. And we were in chapter 4. Specifically, we were going to start by really delving into verses 2 through about verse 4, starting off this evening. And we had been trying to deal with a specific issue the past couple weeks, but if we're going to look at the broad picture of the book of James, what was the overall focus that James was trying to get these people to really think about? What was the overall focus he was pushing for them to have? It's the million-dollar question. What was that? No, it wasn't to do with the old law. Really, it was to focus on who was in charge. To focus on God in particular. And everything we see throughout the book of James, from chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, and now in chapter 4, every single thing we talk about is a comparison on how people live in the world versus this comparison to God. Remember in chapter 1, who he's talking to. He's talking to Jewish Christians who are scattered abroad due to what? Persecution. So they've been scattered abroad due to persecution, and one of the first things that James addresses is God is not the cause of this. God is not the one who caused all of this to come on you. This has nothing to do with God. This has to do with sin. God doesn't tempt people, nor does he doesn't tempt man with sin at all, but every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed. So he deals with sin. Then chapter 2, he talks about how we are to use our tongues. How our tongues are very powerful tools or destructive weapons. And so he tries to show how there's a comparison on how people use their tongues in the world and how they've been used. Some of these people may have been using their tongues and how they treat other people as well. And he says, you don't need to focus on using this tongue this way. No, you need to focus on using it in a constructive manner. Because, as we saw in chapter 2, notice how great a fire a little spark kindles. Then we go into chapter 3, and again it goes really focusing into that tongue. But chapter 4, we start seeing he's beginning to summarize. He's beginning to get down to the bare bones of how all of this is looking, and he's comparing how men have lived in this world and how they are treating one another, and he says this is not how God would have you to live. And we notice that in the very first verse, he says, what causes quarrels and fights among you? Is it not this, that your passions are at war within you? Verse 2, you desire and do not have, so you murder, you covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. Now, that's English Standard Version, but we kind of begin to see a picture forming here. Now, is James saying that these Christians are actually jumping the pews at one another and murdering one another?
Not necessarily, but there are a lot of different fractions in the first Christian church. The Essenes, the Zealots, the Herodians, the Sadducees, the Pharisees, they're all putting their input in at this time, and they're causing confusion in the spirit in the church. And that's what he's talking about.
Yeah, he's talking about this confusion that's beginning to spread, but we go a little bit farther than just these ideologies. You see, here's where we sometimes make a mistake when it comes to studying conflicts in history. We always like to attribute a conflict to some great ideology. You know, World War II was about stopping the evil Nazis. Or, we had the American Revolution was a fight for freedom. There's a difference in why a fight starts historically versus why a fight starts in the middle of it. See, we can go throughout history and we can see all these things take place, but notice what James says about these individuals. What was causing these wars? What was causing these fights and these things that are happening among their brethren?
Selfish desires.
Selfishness. That really does summarize all of what's taking place right here, is James is telling these people, you are idolaters of your own will. We like to use that term idolatry, but we like to separate ourselves from it. We like to say, oh yeah, idolaters. That's like those people over in India or in the Middle East in some places or in Africa where they're worshiping these wood or stone objects. But really, idolatry goes far deeper than that. Idolatry literally carries with it the idea of I am putting something as a god. Now, what would that mean? If I'm saying I'm making something a god, what does that mean?
One thing, I think that we don't have balance in our life and we devote all our time and efforts to one thing, and in that way it becomes a god to us.
And you used a very important word there. For those who couldn't hear, Frank was describing how a god can be we're not balancing our lives, and so we put all of our focus and our attention into one thing. But he used a word there that I really appreciated. He used the word devote. Devote. A god is something that I am devoted to. So that's one description of how I can make a god. What's another way that something is my god? Okay, but what does that mean? What does it mean to idolize something?
You're more foreign. You want to. Oh, you put that first above God.
You put that first, and you also you said something else. You care about it.
Yeah.
So we have devotion, a focus. We have care, but also a care to the point where I care what this thing is, or if it's a person, what that person thinks. So we're starting to see something, right? A god is something that changes my actions. I am willing to change my actions to follow something or get closer to it. Now, if we're thinking about this in the religious sense, if I am a follower of God and I say, God, you are my God, the Lord God Jehovah, if I say, you are my God, what am I saying to him? Whatever you want, I will follow. What I'm saying to God is my thoughts are going to be on how I can get closer to you. My actions are going to be focused on furthering what you want to be done. My life, the things that I enjoy, those things are going to be only the things that allow me to stay close with you. That's what I'm saying to him. I'm saying everything about me belongs to you. Now, let's put this in the modern sense. Let's think about this in context with us as 2024 Americans. What are some of the idols we see today?
Cell phones.
Okay, we heard sports. What's another one?
Cell phones.
Cell phones. We got cell phones. We got sports. What else?
Cars.
Money. All these things. None of us have ever been guilty of worshiping those gods, are we? But let's think about those things. Let's put that in thought to what we just said with what he's describing here. If I am idolatrizing something, making it my God, let's say it's the realm of sports. I know you can say it. I've been to games in Knoxville. I've been to certain sporting events. And you watch people who that sport is their God. You know how I know it? They will dress the part. They will act the part. They might commit a felony if their team doesn't do well. It's their God. So much of their personality is wrapped up in this. Every time you talk to them, it's like, how's it going? Well, my team lost this weekend. Great, how are you? See, that's how so many people make it. Instead of it just being, oh, I've had a week that I've done X and Y. No, my team lost, therefore I'm not having a good week. See how this begins to form? Or in the realm of hobbies. Hobbies are not a bad thing. No one's ever going to say that hobbies are a bad thing. But when do they become a bad thing? When does a hobby change from a hobby to an idol?
When you put it before God.
Okay, and how can I do that? Not serving God as you should, devoting more time and attention. What was the other one?
I said unfaithful.
It makes you unfaithful. When we tend to think of this term idolatry, It usually comes down to one area where we say, well, I don't come to church because of it. And while, yes, that is a form of idolatry, and we need to make sure that is established, friends, it's not just about whether or not it prevents us from coming to church. That's not the only way that something is an idol.
But you can't be a lover of the world and a lover of God.
Exactly, and we're going to get to that point, and so hold on just for a second, we'll get there. But when we're holding on to this thought here, if we're having a God that we're holding on to, an idol, something that is preventing me from getting closer to God, friends, it's not just that it prevented me from coming to church. It also matters on, does it change my attitude towards people? Does it affect my love of souls? Does it change my willingness to evangelize? Does it leave me with no energy to follow after God? Does it prevent me from learning more about God in general on my own time? Go ahead.
Does it affect your giving? Because more money has to go to that instead of what maybe you would have put in church.
That matters of it too. When we think about, even in that term, because that was a very interesting point to be brought up with the giving. When the widow gave her 2 mites, did she give a lot of money? She gave a lot of money, but it was a small amount. Because she gave first. She had a focus. This is for God first. Now, we're not saying that, you know, as a Christian, I have to sell everything that I have, that I have to live in a monastery and study the Bible every day, and I get to come out to talk to people about the Bible, and then I have to go back and study more. That's not what we're talking about here. Because we can even go to Acts chapter 5 and we can see Ananias and Sapphira. And what did Peter tell them when they didn't sell, when they said they sold everything and gave all the money? What did Peter say to them about their property?
It's yours to do with what you want to do with.
When it was yours, was it not your own to do what you wanted to? It would have been righteous for Ananias and Sapphira to sell a portion of their land, take some of that money and give it to the church. That would have been a good thing for them to do. But they chose instead to do exactly what James was just talking about. It was based on their lusts. It was based on these own selfish desires that they wanted fulfilled because they saw what Barnabas got in Acts chapter 4. They said, everyone's looking at this guy. He sold everything that he had, and these guys are giving him pats on the back, and these guys think he's wonderful. And so, you know, if we were to lie to them, if we were to say we did the same thing, we'll get the same praise. Peter was addressing how that was sinful, and James is addressing how it's also sinful here. So notice what he says next, though. And I see a hand up here somewhere. Go ahead.
I just want to mention one thing. In the Old Testament, it talks about, I don't know exactly where the reference is found, he says, you live in your sealed houses while God's house is in ruin. And I think that's, looking at our society today, you go by and you look at some of these houses, and how can you justify, you know, I mean, I'm not saying it's wrong to have those, but I mean, extravagance that we live in today, you know, it's just amazing.
I've asked this question to people. If it came down to, I have to choose between having any kind of comfort or choosing a job or something like that and choosing God, what is my knee-jerk response going to be? Most people, it would be comfort. Most people, well, I got to work. I got to make a living. Absolutely. Absolutely, you do. I mean, God even described that those who will not provide for his own household is worse than an infidel. But if that job is making it harder for me to follow God, there's other jobs. And that's coming from someone also who has been unemployed for a certain amount of time, and it's very difficult to find jobs. I'm not saying that because I don't understand that. But anything that separates me from God has to be sacrificed. Anything that hinders that, and that's what James is dealing with right here, is this warning against worldliness. Against loving this world more. Notice what he says, verse 2. You desire and do not have. So you murder, you covet, and cannot obtain. So you fight and quarrel, you do not have, because you do not ask. Let's read this again, but let's look at this from the King James Version. He says, you lust and have not. You kill and desire to have and cannot obtain. Ye fight and war, yet ye have not, because you ask not. Now notice this in verse 3. You ask and receive not, because ye ask amiss, that ye may consume it upon your own lusts. So again, we're going to ask this question. Were they actually killing one another? Actually jumping over the pews? I mean, are we looking at something that looks reminiscent to the, what was the old Ray Stevens song, The Squirrel Went to Mississippi Squirrel, or something like that, where people are running around acting crazy? No, that's not what we're talking about here. Can we do damage to someone without physically hurting them? Where do you see the most division in any institution? Where do you see the most damage done to individuals in an institution? Is it usually the ones that are really struggling or really working to get something done? Not usually. Yeah, the slander that we're talking about, but when we're talking about these institutions and things of that nature, usually the institutions that are struggling the most have the most. Usually the institutions where we see the most of this stuff happening is not those that are struggling. If we look at the United States of America right now, even in spite of 2024 being a wonderful economic year, do we see more problems in individuals going against one another than in years where we weren't as economic of a power as we are now? And we can chalk that up to a lot of different things. We can say, well, that's just because people nowadays don't appreciate anything, or you know, the youth of today, they don't know what it means to have to work for something. We can say all these different arguments, but really it comes down to a baseline of we're selfish. We're selfish. As humanity, as individuals, as a whole, we are selfish. Whether it has people in the past who are saying, well, everyone's destroying what we had, it's still a level of selfishness. Because, well, I had something good and you went and ruined it, and so now I'm going to be mad. If we go back in history and we see the things that people have had before, yeah, you might have had a nicer house, but there was still murder. There was still theft. There was still gambling. There was still sexual immorality that was rampant. All that stuff was still happening. The times that division, that fighting happens the most is in people who are focused on anything but God. And that's what James is addressing right off the bat. Selfish desires. That's exactly what we're dealing with right here, because he noticed what he says. Ye lust and have not. Ye kill and desire to have and cannot attain. Ye fight and war, yet ye have not because ye ask not. These people are trying to cause these fights to get something they want at the expense of someone else. And notice even what he said in verse 3. Ye ask and receive not because ye ask amiss that ye may consume it upon your own lust. He says you're even praying for things, and you're not getting it. Why? Because you're not even asking for those things for the right reasons. You're asking for those things, again, so you can consume it where? The exact same place you're fighting over. You kind of see where the problems are coming? Do you start to see where the parallels run with today? Not much has really changed.
Anybody but himself.
For those who couldn't hear, Frank was mentioning the parable where the man, he looks out on his, he had a great harvest, and he says, well, I've got this great harvest, and so I'm going to tear down my barns and build bigger barns. Now, for many of us today, we say, that's a sound entrepreneur right there. Look at him go. How many of you have heard the statement that your heart matters more than your actions? A lot of people have said that. And to a degree, I can see where their reasoning is. But it really is not your heart matters more than your actions. It's that they both matter. What you do matters, and how you are motivated matters as well. But is it true that I can do the exact same thing under two different circumstances and one be right and one be wrong? Let me give an example. Can I give to a charity and it be wrong? How might that be?
Depends on what kind of charity it is.
Well, let's assume the charity's good. let's assume the charity. For sake of experiment here, the charity is a good charity. Okay? What was that? If you gloat after you do it, because what was your motivation?
Yourself. Or to avoid taxes.
That's... we're not going to go there. But yeah, if it has to do just with yourself, then it really wasn't charity. It really wasn't just giving to someone. Yeah. Now, there could be a situation where, yeah, you get a tax break to it. Cool. Awesome. Sweet. Adds to it. But if that's my motivation, that's wrong. If gloating about it is my motivation, that's wrong. Let's go beyond that. It's not just wrong, it's sinful. It is something that separates us from God. Because what kind of giving did God praise? Private, selfless giving. It's not wrong to get praise for something you did, because it wasn't wrong for Barnabas to get praise. The apostles didn't come in and start breaking everybody up with sticks and saying, don't praise him for that, that's wrong. No, they were saying this is something that's worthy of being praised and shown this is good. So there are circumstances where it can be done differently. So notice what he's saying there, though. You ask and receive not because you ask amiss that you may consume it upon your own lusts. Friends, there are things we can do claiming to serve God that could be wrong because of why we're doing it. If my only reason to worship God is because I have to be here, is that acceptable worship to God? Why is that?
You're supposed to be worshiping the Spirit and the truth, and that's who God is seeking. Someone who's want to be here. He's seeking after Acts 17 and 20, what, 6? Seeking after him.
I believe you're right. So if God is seeking for us to be serving Him, being here because we are praising Him, worshiping Him, lauding Him, just for a quick time out, does anyone know what the word worship actually translates to?
Praise God, glorify Him.
It's a little bit different. The word for worship carries with it to kiss the hand towards, which to for a comparison, illustration lets you really know what that means. It's like how a dog licks its master's hand. When we are worshiping God, it has nothing to do with elevating us. Nothing to do at all. Because when I am worshiping God, when I'm saying to Him, you are greater than me, I'm humbling myself to show that. I show you how great you are, how wonderful you are, and I'm willing to praise you because you've only asked one day. You've only asked of me one day that I give to you in a sense like this. The rest of the week, I still should live for you. I still should sacrifice myself for you because that's what you've asked. I mean, that's Romans 12, 1 and 2, right? But you've asked one day to worship you. Not a time of the day, not something I have to interrupt everything to. No, one day. And for many people, that's too much to ask. Why? Why would that be too much to ask? What might some of the reasoning be? Maybe James chapter 4, verses 1 through 3. I've got more important things to do. I got better things to do with my time. It's how a lot of people tend to think. And when it comes to our world especially, I've heard so many people say, and you've heard preachers say this before, but it bears repeating because it's worth hearing. The reality is, friends, we're not losing a lot of people in the church. A lot of people weren't there to begin with. A lot of people found an excuse to get out. When we see the number of young people that are no longer faithful, or they go off to college and they don't worship God anymore, there are countless people who have started saying, newly found evidence suggests. It's not newly found evidence. It's always been the case. But this newly found evidence they suggest is that these kids are not losing their faith when they get to college. They didn't have it before they got there. And a lot of that starts because they see what their parents believe. They know what's important to you. Speaking from someone who's not that far removed and who just preached his papa's funeral, we know what was important in our family. Even if I went and did whatever toe-headed thing I wanted to do, I knew to mom and dad their faith was real. Because if we were in a ball game, we were pulled out of that ball game. We might could play part of it, and we'd show up to that VBS in cleats and dirty pants, but we'd be there. But it's not just the worship setting. It's how do you live your life? How do I live my life? What example am I showing? These people, they had a focus only on this world. And it was backfiring big time. He's saying, this is not how you're supposed to live. This is the same attitude that we saw David get into as well. David, the man after God's own heart, the man who said, bring on the giant. I took the lion and the bear. Now that's a man who's not worldly, because if I'm worldly, I'm saying I ain't touching that bear and I ain't touching that lion. He can stay as far away from me as possible. You have that lamb chop, I'm okay. But he knew who his God was, and he was willing to do that. When the giant came along, did the same thing. But when Bathsheba came along, his focus was not on God. In fact, he wasn't even where he was supposed to be in the first place. He was given a way out. He could have walked away from that.
He was told.
Yeah, he had every opportunity to walk away from this, to leave it. He didn't even have to get to the Uriah point. He didn't even have to get to the adultery in of itself. He could have stopped it before it got there.
When his servant told him.
So you have all these things that pop up, but when we get down to it, most of the fights, most of the arguments, most of the destruction that happens within churches comes from a place of worldliness rather than a place of godliness. We have got to be careful with how we look at the Word of God, with how we look at God Himself, because I hear even members of the Lord's church sometimes say, well, we're going to run people off if we tell them that. Friends, the only people who are going to be run off by hearing the Word of God are people who don't want Him. People who are interested, they'll listen. They'll hear. So when we're looking at this section here, and we're talking about how James is trying to address this, and we're going to have to hurry, because I know we just had the first bell, and I don't know how we already had the first bell. But we're going to get to verse 4 here. He says, you adulterous people. Now, it's funny how you see that in the ESV, because in King James, he makes it even more specific. He says, you adulterers and adulteresses. He says, we're making sure we include everybody here. you adulterers and adulteresses, know ye not that friendship of the world is enmity with God? Why would he call them adulterers and adulteresses? Where does that come from? We didn't hear about them cheating on spouses here, did we?
Spiritual.
What is the church's relationship to God? It's the bride of Christ. We're all a part of this kingdom, this bride of Christ. If I'm holding to the ways of the world when I'm supposed to be in a covenant relationship with God, what have I done? I've breached the contract.
Breached the covenant.
When I became a member of the Lord's church, I said to God, I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. He is the ruler. He is the one who's in charge. I'm pledging myself to Him. When I go back into the world, what have I just done to that pledge? Destroyed it. I said, no. You're king, but not right now. Not when I've got this going on. He calls them adulterers and adulteresses. Does that kind of change the tune a little bit from how we say, how people commit sins today? Say, oh, that's a little hiccup. He'll be okay. There is a fine line that we have to walk between helping people who are in a right relationship with God know that they're okay with God and letting people know sin is serious. Because there are some people who have a tender heart and it's a wonderful thing. But there's some people who they can look at this attitude when they say that they've sinned and they think, oh, God's never going to accept me now because I messed up. I sinned against God, so He's going to reject me. Where are you doing after that? After you made that mistake, what was your response to it? On the other hand, we have people who say, well, I can keep on sinning, and God's a gracious God, and so He's going to help me get along. Everything's going to be fine. There's a fine line to walk there of helping to understand the seriousness of sin, but also know the goodness of God. And notice what he said here. Friendship of the world is enmity with God. We haven't had the second bell, have we? Okay, good. So, is enmity with God. What does that word enmity mean? Hatred. That's the simplest definition. Hatred. Friendship with the world is enmity with God. If someone today, let's look at it from this perspective. If America was at war with another nation, and one of our senators went and had dinner in the capital of the enemy nation with the enemy leader, what would we say about that person? We're going to call him a traitor before we even know what that conversation was about. Why? You're friending yourself with the enemy. You're spending your time with the enemy. That's how God is viewing that situation with us when we have a covenant relationship with the world versus Him. And that's where we're going to stop. I promise we will get to verse 5 at some point. But that's where we're going to pick up next time. Thank you so much for your attention.